Tom Reed with my personal radio column, It Seems to Me. Today I have a very special guest host. I think you're familiar with her because she has been a guest on this program many times, and she has a special guest today. My guest host is Dr. Rita Steck.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate you asking us back. We have Dr. Jeff Bond with us again. Thank you so much for joining us, Jeff. We know your time is very busy.
It's a pleasure to come back.
But in the first show we did, it was kind of esoteric, the scientific background, trying to explain to you the whys and the research behind the various nutritional recommendations that we give our listeners. So today what we thought we would do is just get down to the nitty-gritty. Okay, when you get up in the morning, what are you going to eat? What are you going to drink when you go shopping? So, Jeff, to start us out, tell us what you have for breakfast.
Yes, this is often a big question because we've been so brainwashed just in the last 50 years to think that breakfast cereals are the only way to start a breakfast that we've lost touch with what our grandparents used to do, let alone what the ancient foragers might be doing. So, just to go back a little bit in time, I can remember when my grandparents would have for breakfast a nice piece of poached haddock with grilled tomatoes, grilled mushrooms, and grilled onions. Hey, that's terrific. Absolutely perfect. I can remember back in the 50s when the first packet of cornflakes was brought into Britain after the rationing ended. And we looked at this thing and we said, well, what do you do with it? And they said, well, you put it in a bowl and you pour milk on it. And we said, well, milk? We don't do milk. We were one of these odd families that didn't do milk already. But try it with hot water. So we tried it with hot water.
Yuck.
And we didn't like that either. So we gave up on cornflakes. But that's a sort of joking aside. But yes, you think of other items. One of the main things to understand about meals is that what you can eat for one meal, you can eat for any other meal. For example, if you go to Asia and they'll often give you a nice shrimp and vegetable stir fry for breakfast. Hey, nothing wrong with that. That's terrific. In Africa, we might be eating a guinea fowl, roasted guinea fowl and vegetable salad. Hey, nothing wrong with that for breakfast. I know it's kind of having to shift your ideas of what's normal. But there again, eggs, any style, mushroom omelette, boiled eggs, fine. We'll have a talk about the detail of the eggs a little later. But eggs were part of the human diet right through human history. In fact, that helped them live. And the women would be very good at finding them and digging them out from wherever they were, the ostrich eggs, the bustard eggs, the flamingo eggs, and so forth. So don't worry about eggs. But there is a little caveat to that, which we might get into later. So, yeah, and indeed, there is other things you can do too. For example, if you want to get into this, you can even make English muffins that are safe to eat, which are not made with grains, made with almond flour, for example. There's even a recipe in my wife's cookbook called Paleo Harvest. So there is, in fact, a vast variety of foods to eat, including, hey, why not just have a bowl of low-glycemic, low-sugar fruits, mainly working on the berries? So there is, in fact, a huge range of options if you're just prepared to break out of the box a little bit with your thinking.
Yes, I think you hit the nail on the head there. We certainly have been brainwashed by Kellogg's and McDonald's and, you know, all these other companies who have defined for us breakfast food, and we really have to think outside of that box, no pun intended, get out of the cereal box. And when I'm counseling patients, because nutrition, in my mind, if you're not paying attention to nutrition and making good choices, there's no medication that can take the place of that. And the most frequent question I get is, well, what do you eat for breakfast? So I'll tell you personally, currently, and this has changed from when we've had this conversation with Tom in the past, currently I start my day out with a bowl of chia seed in almond milk. Now, Chia seed comes primarily from South America, although I believe it's now grown in the United States as well. But it is a gluten-free, it is not a grain, strictly speaking.
It's not a grass seed. Yeah.
Yes. But it's high in protein, it's high in fiber, it's high in the good fatty acids, and it's filling. So a couple tablespoons of, and I actually grind them. Some people just put the seeds into the almond milk or water, if you prefer. But I grind them 2 tablespoons in a cup of warm almond milk, and I end up with something that's much like oatmeal. Now, the chia is a bit bitter, and so I sweeten it with stevia, and I throw in some cinnamon and some anise seeds, and then just a few raisins, and it's really quite filling. So that lasts me to mid-morning. And mid-morning is when I have a hard-boiled egg. And Jeff, you mentioned eggs also. So let's talk about eggs for a bit here. When I was in medical school, eggs were no-no. Oh, no, don't eat eggs. The yolk is full of cholesterol, and so if you eat them, you're going to raise your cholesterol. And the research since then has shown us differently. So maybe you could speak briefly to why eggs are actually more than okay. And the whole egg, you don't have to throw out that delicious, nutrient-rich yolk.
Right. Well, as I mentioned, eggs have been part of the human diet for a very long time. I mentioned there was a caveat or a warning. And that is, yes, the eggs have to be, or the creatures that produce the eggs have to be fed in the way the creatures was designed to live, just like human beings have to be fed the way that human beings are designed to live. And the main problem is that with modern eggs, as they are chicken eggs, as they are produced today, battery hens, they're not fed in a way which produces the right kind of fatty acid profile. And in particular, we're talking about the good fatty acids. So what you can do is make sure that you get what they call omega-3 rich eggs, preferably free range. And then you've got the right kind of fatty acid profile. And it's extraordinary. If you can get farmyard eggs from chickens that have been running around a farmyard, they've been pecking at big bugs, they've been pecking at seeds, they've been pecking at greenery, they produce eggs which are absolutely wonderful to taste, but they're also got the terrific fatty acid profile which fits the human being fatty acid profile. Now, just coming back to the question of cholesterol, yes, quite naturally, eggs contain cholesterol. But, and I think as you mentioned, Rita, we now know that if people have high cholesterol levels, it's not because they're eating it, it's because their body makes it when it shouldn't be. And that really, whether you eat it or not, doesn't make any difference. In fact, one of the interesting things is that foragers living in the way nature intended, in a state of nature, they actually have a very high cholesterol intake from the various foods they're eating. But on the other hand, they have very low cholesterol levels. And that's because their bodies sort out the cholesterol levels just fine. The bodies recognize the way they're living. And their bodies are not making cholesterol, unlike Westerners, when they shouldn't be.
And I believe it's the bad saturated fats that feed into that cycle of cholesterol production. So it's if you're concerned about your cholesterol, it's avoid the bad fatty acids rather than avoid cholesterol and AIDS.
The whole question of cholesterol can almost be a bit of a red herring too. I mean, having high cholesterol of its own or reducing it through medications isn't necessarily particularly helpful health-wise. What is important is to get down to forager levels. And if we're going to talk about high cholesterol, I don't know if we want to get technical about this, so we won't go. We'll leave that for another day. But just simply say this is one of the reasons why dairy is we would avoid dairy because it does raise cholesterol levels, and that's why we avoid grains, because they raise cholesterol levels through the insulin reaction.
And when you say dairy, what we mean specifically is cow's milk and all its products.
We're talking about Milk.
Milk.
and even human milk if you're more than 4 years old.
Okay. Before we leave our discussion on eggs, let's talk a bit about cooking. The temperature at which we cook our food and its exposure to oxygen and oxidation in the food is important. And so I understand that we don't want to cook our foods at super high levels, like frying and broiling, but more poaching, and that perhaps the ideal way to cook an egg is either poaching it or boiling it in its shell, because then it's not exposed to the oxygen so much and we avoid AGEs. Would you explain AGEs briefly to our listeners?
Well, AGEs are advanced glycation end products. Yes, they're kind of the Darth Vader of our cells, and we try to avoid having too much of them. The body makes them itself, but they also come into our food through high temperature cooking, particularly of meats and other things. And it's something that we would rather not have. So, but we can get a little hung up again on all this detail, and I like to drag it back to, well, what happened in forager times? And these peoples would be cooking. They would certainly throw bits of meat into the embers of a fire, and various kinds of roots that they would dig up. They would roast them in the fire. So it's not as though cooking's out of the question, and even cooking at a temperature of roasting is not necessarily out of the question. But what we have to understand is that the problem with particularly with AGEs is that it's due to the fats that are oxidizing, and that these people weren't eating much in the way of roasted fat. The meat was very, very low fat. 1% fat, perhaps, which is, of course, almost as though unnoticeable. And the bottom line is, hey, it didn't really matter. At that level, the body's coped with it. Whereas what we do today, and particularly it's barbecuing and cooking, particularly in those kinds of ways, which are unhelpful and is producing these kinds of compounds, which are the Darth Vader of our blood vessels. So as a rule of thumb, yes, the steaming, the boiling, that's the kind of thing perhaps not so much the boiling is good. And if you're cooking, you're sautéing, yes, keep the temperatures down, because it's the oxidized fats which really are quite a menace to our bodies. They churn out free radicals, which our bodies then struggle to handle.
Excellent. Now let's talk about peanuts. A lot of my patients, and I think most people, really don't understand that peanuts are in a totally different family from almonds, cashews, what we would call tree nuts. And as I tell my patients, you know, the tree nuts are excellent. You know, you want to carry a little snack with you, so in the middle of the day you get hungry, instead of pulling into, you know, one of the fast food restaurants, reach into your bag and, you know, have a few nuts. But tell us why peanuts are pretty much on the no-no list.
Yes, you're quite right. The tree nuts basically are fine. And certainly tree nuts, were a mainstay of the diet for hunter-gatherers. In fact, that's where they got most of their fats from, was from nuts rather than from animals or plants. But if we're talking about peanuts, yes, they belong to a totally different class of plant. They belong to what we call legumes or pulses. In other words, they're the same family as lentils and beans, and garbanzo beans, for example. And that was that class of plant was also the one that came into the diet at the time of the farming revolution. And they contain compounds that, again, are anti-nutrients, plant toxins that our bodies don't know how to handle. And, you know, we don't have to be particularly, it's not rocket science. We know that peanuts are a huge source of allergies. So right there, we know that they're a problem for human beings in general. But they contain other kinds of anti-nutrients too, which are unhelpful and which we're better off without. Now, I never talked a lot about beans before the soybean came into the diet in a huge way, and now it's ground up and put in to extend breads and all kinds of processed foods, and some people even eat it thinking it might be doing them some good. But there again, the soybean is full of anti-nutrients, which we know about as being particularly harmful, and it's got over 16 allergens, of which three are regarded as major. So, you know, it's not for nothing that often you buy a food that's in a packet or a can and it says soy-free or allergen information contains soy. Yeah, hey, you know, we shouldn't be eating it. It's not human food, and it's not even good for the pigs that it was originally imported to feed.
But that's a hard one for people to, I think, really believe, in spite of the science that's there. But folks, we're just giving you the science and research. This is not just our opinions on it.
Yes, I think this is. We have to keep repeating this. You're absolutely right, Rita, because people say, "Oh, he's just making it up." You know, this is just your kind of view or your gut feeling. It isn't. This is the data and the evidence. And I give lectures to doctors as part of their continuing medical education, because I can say these things where it's not part of the conventional approach very often, whether it's in conventional medicine or even dietitians and nutritionists who have to follow particular protocols which are established by various kinds of organizations. Coming from the background I do, I can put this totally different picture on and perspective on it. And in particular, I think I can give, what I try and do is give people priorities. Because a lot of this is confusing, and you have to say to yourself, well, you know, where do I actually focus my energies most, and where do I try and avoid, getting distracted by perhaps something which isn't so relevant? And maybe, Rita, you've got some ideas about that.
Well, it can get confusing, and I find myself sometimes saying, well, should I eat this vegetable or that vegetable? And again, so I go back to the science and go back to Jeff's book and list of vegetables. And so let's talk about the vegetables that you mm-hmm. eat, that I eat on a daily basis. So moving on from breakfast and mid-morning snack, for lunch, I will often have a salad with different lettuces in it, the darker lettuces, usually a little cucumber, some tomatoes, and I may throw in a few walnuts, you know, mm-hmm. to give it a bit of crunch and some protein. And of course, I do have to put a little bit of a dressing on it. I can't eat it dry. What's your usual lunch?
Well, that's pretty much what we do too, you know, a nice big salad. I do talk about trying to have some raw vegetables in your diet, and people think, oh my God, I've got to eat raw cabbage or something. Well, no, just a regular salad, the mixed salad with all the things we think of as being salad vegetables is fine. And you do just mm-hmm. what you've said, Rita. Lettuces, lettuce leaves of various kinds. You don't have to be complicated about it. Sometimes you just get a bunch of lettuce leaves and a piece of cucumber and a piece of tomato and just eat it straight off the plate.
So which vegetables should we truly avoid? Now, personally, potatoes, because they're so starchy and I just don't need all those extra calories. But could you give us the best vegetables and the worst vegetables? Because some people, again, we're trying to make this easier for you when you go shopping, ladies and gentlemen. And not everything in the produce section of the grocery store should really go home with you.
Yes, I don't want to. I think I can make it even simpler. I think I can just say that almost anything you call a vegetable, except for potato, is probably okay. And some things are going to be better than others, perhaps. But just to come back to potato, one of the things we're having to do is to stop filling ourselves up on starches, which, apart from the other problems, it means that we're micronutrient poor. So we starve ourselves of micronutrients by filling ourselves up on potato, or French fries, or baked potato, or however it's done. And what we do need to be doing is replacing it with micronutrient-rich foods. And so I would say that as a rule of thumb, pretty much everything except potato is okay. You want to go a little light on sweet potato, on parsnips, which are also starchy, and be a little careful of go a little light on carrots too, particularly if you're diabetic. I think even conventional medicine says, diabetics have to be a little careful
because of what's called the glycemic, because it's sugary.
Yeah. It's sugary. Yeah. So otherwise, yes, it's the green beans, it's the broccoli, it's the cabbages, it's all those things that we commonly think of as vegetables.
So. And if they have color, they're much better. That usually indicates...
That rule of thumb is the good yeah. one, yes. The colored okay. vegetables, yes.
Okay. Now, the challenge very often is going to the restaurant, or many of my ladies say, well, when friends invite us over for dinner, what do I do? And I say, well, first of all, remember, this is your body. You're responsible for it, and what you put in it is your choice. Now, don't be so afraid of offending your hostess. Just graciously say, my doctor said these are the things I should not eat, so I just want to let you know this. So it's an easy, I think, social dilemma to get out of. So what I have found, most restaurants, and I have to say, well, you're going to know why I occasionally go into a fast food restaurant, because Carl's Jr. now carries grass-fed hamburgers, and they will give them to you in a lettuce wrap. Now, in the hamburger family, that's relatively healthy. So my point here is I think most restaurants are now aware that the public is aware that, you know, we're getting more health conscious. And so don't be bashful about asking what's in a particular dish or asking for, your salad dressing on the side, for example. But what do you do when you go into a restaurant and, you know, it's an evening out, so you're going to give yourself a little leeway to enjoy food, but you don't want to fall too far off the wagon.
Right. Well, you're absolutely right, Rita. You know, this is the only body we've got, and we've got to look after it. You know, it's not like a car. When it's worn out, we can just buy another one. When ours is worn out, where are you going to go? So, look after it. And the trouble is, most people look after their cars better than they look after their bodies. This is, you know, treat it seriously, this question of negotiating what you're going to be eating as best you can. In a restaurant, you can be assertive. You can look at what's on the menu and you can see that there's something, you know, the smoked salmon or something on one side and there's broccoli over here. So you can ask for the French fries to be replaced by the broccoli and so forth, and negotiate. And to be honest, I'm British, but I've spent most of my life almost everywhere else in the world. I find that you can do this in restaurants, except for the finest dining, where the chef really gets upset if you mess around with the beauty of the plate of his creation. So yes, do this, and people don't be inhibited about just negotiating with the waiter, saying how you'd like it, and they'll do it for you. Clearly, it's a little more difficult when you're going out to eat with friends. So they've invited you over, you just say, "Look, I'm just happy to have a big salad and a piece of fish, or whatever. Something that's simple, something you know will work for them, and don't make it too difficult for them. Because otherwise, you never get invited out at all."
Well, and also that can start a conversation about healthy eating and nutrition, and you can share your information with a friend, and get us all healthier in the community.
That can certainly happen, although I find my reputation goes ahead of me, and people are always a little nervous, first of all, about what's going on.
Yes, I know, Jeff. When you come over to our home for dinner, it's a week of planning the menu. But you mentioned raw vegetables earlier, mm-hmm. and I wanted to come back to that for a minute. Raw, I think in terms of the nutrients in the vegetables, raw is usually considered best because you're not going to mm-hmm. lose any nutrients through steaming or sautéing or whatever. But what I've found with my patients who are, you know, already in their, even if they're in their 20s, let alone 50s or 60s, if you've been unconsciously abusing your gastrointestinal system, your stomach and your intestines, with the wrong foods, and you have a lot of inflammation, you know, going on in your gastrointestinal tract, to suddenly decide, I'm going to eat healthy and I'm just going to eat this big plate of 3 cups of raw vegetables, you're going to regret it. Because while that's the ideal, you have to gradually introduce these changes to your system. And then once the inflammation is down, then yeah, if you want to eat more raw vegetables, I think it's okay.
Well, yes, I agree. And I think you're probably there, you're in the driving or the coal face there. You're actually seeing what happens with patients and you're able to follow them as they progress. Certainly, I have people come to me and say, you know, I can't eat a salad, or certainly not in the volumes you're talking about. One lettuce leaf is about as much as it goes. And you have to think, well, yes, their digestive system has atrophied over, you know, whatever, the length of time. And it's suddenly, it's a shock. It's got to start working again. But that's how our digestive system is designed to work. It's supposed to work on stuff that's indigestible.
Right.
and we've got to train it up, limber it up, and you just take it as fast as you can, as you can cope with.
Yes, I think... For those of you who are making the decision, okay, I'm ready to do this and eat healthier, do it gradually. And to help guide you, Jeff has a book called Deadly Harvest, which is, I have to say, I'll be honest, it's not an easy read, but it's got, well, because there's so much information in it. It's more of a reference book, but excellent guide. You have a lot of tables in the back and suggestions how to eat healthy. So tell us where our listeners can get your book, Deadly Harvest.
Right, you can get it on Amazon and all good bookshops, and it is available on my website, www.naturaleater.com.
Excellent. And I have read Jeff's book. I have 2 copies, one at home, one in my office. And I have to tell you, I frequently go back to double-check information or to reference it again for my patients. Also, I'll give you a reminder of my book, A Woman's Home Health Companion, also available on Amazon.com. It's available in Kindle, and it's... It, of course, does not have the detail that Jeff's book has, but the nutrition sections are kind of a simple guide to getting healthier and putting yourself in the driver's seat for your own health and wellness. So, Tom, I want to thank you again for this wonderful opportunity for both Jeff and myself to be talking with your listeners. And again, I hope we have given you food for thought.
My thanks to Dr. Rita Steck and her guest for being guest hosts today on It Seems to Me. This is Tom Reed. Thanks for listening.